Rowan Anderson had a fairly familiar story, I'm sure, to many of us. He was living in Melbourne, he was working 6 days, making plenty of money, but not altogether happy. And that realisation made him think he needed to make a change. That realisation and some harsh words from a doctor, I suspect. So he moved to Ballarat and 3 years ago moved onto a property where he grows his own fruit, veg, keeps animals, hunts and forages. He's now a hunter, farmer, blogger and thoroughly busy person, but a happier one. And he's had a year of what he calls practiculture. And he joins us on the show now. Good morning, Rowan.
G'day.
Look, thanks so much for coming on the show. I'm going to start with a bit of terminology. What do you mean by practiculture?
Well, that's it. Just, you know, I should say up front, it is a completely made-up word, but it's a bit of fun, and it explains my approach to life. So I was running a workshop teaching people how to skin rabbits one day, and a bloke said to me everything you do is really practical. You don't do much, you know, activities that are, you know, based on folly. Everything you do has some sort of practical outcome. He says, it's a very practical culture. And he said, practiculture. And the guy worked in marketing, obviously, and I said, I'm going to use that. That is a fantastic way to describe what I do. So that's where the word came from.
I like that you foraged even for the word. That's the best way to go.
Exactly.
So I'm interested in that because it sounds, firstly, surely you still indulge. You do things that aren't practical, that are about pleasure.
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
Good to hear. I was going to be worried about you otherwise.
Well, and you know what? A lot of the things that I do actually that are practical, some people would consider them to be quite pleasurable. I mean, people go out of their way to garden as an activity, and that's quite pleasurable, but it's also practical.
So I'm interested in, because you grow, you hunt, you forage, does that mean you're entirely self-sufficient?
No, definitely not. And I think the word in itself is a paradox, the term self-sufficiency. Look, I still need to buy soap and toilet paper and olive oil, but I do as much as possible. And, you know, I would say as a rough calculation, about 80% of our fresh food comes from the backyard, either the fruit and the veggies or the stuff that I've hunted. The other beautiful thing about it, this self-sufficiency idealism, is that if you embed yourself in a community of like-minded people, you've got a lot of food to trade for, and that makes life a lot easier, and you avoid the supermarkets.
I think that's really interesting, taking the emphasis off the self in self-sufficiency, that you're part of a community that serves each other and is kind of an ecosystem.
Exactly, and it is a system that's been in existence in many human cultures for thousands of years. It's worked really well. It's interesting that most people think that this is a system that works only in the country environment, but in fact, I'm seeing it more and more exist in the city environment, where people are producing their own food in their backyard, making pickles and relishes, or curing pork and sharing it with friends. And I think that's quite promising.
So talk to us about the kind of light bulb moment that led to this change, because it was a pretty drastic change for you.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's been, you know, those really low voltage energy saver globes. That's the best way for me to describe those light bulb moments, just little dimly lit moments where some catalyst has arrived in my life to say, you need to make change. So initially being confirmed that I was morbidly obese by my GP, and I had hypertension and anxiety and depression, so medical issues from the food that I was eating from supermarkets. I had a diet of very highly processed food. I became very unhealthy because of that. So that was one of the light bulb moments. And then, you know, I started feeling guilt about what I was feeding my daughters. I was feeding them chicken nuggets from the supermarket, for example. So, you know, there's another light bulb moment. So just little dimly lit moments that said, Rowan, you need to make some change.
Well, apart from anything else, the word morbidly is really depressing. If you were described as cheerfully obese, that's something you could embrace. But morbidly obese, who wants that?
Exactly. About 5 years ago, when I was putting my first book together, The Age said that I was portly. I wasn't disgraced by that. I thought, portly's pretty good.
No, you want a portly person around. They're going to be good company.
Exactly. You know, apple cider, you know, a couple of drinks and some, you know, a pork pie and a portly fella. Everyone's going to enjoy that.
Life of the party, without question. But, you know, you do mention your daughters. I mean, this is not just a life choice you've made for yourself. You've imposed this on your family. It's a decision you've made together. How did they take that, and how have they adapted to the change?
Well, thankfully, my youngest daughter was still very young and hasn't really noticed the difference. She's always had the crazy dad that lives in the country and eats a particular type of food. My eldest daughter, it was a slow progression, and it took, you know, a bit of determination to work with her to get her to move from, you know, they're quite tasty. I mean, food is engineered, processed food is engineered to get our brain saying, that is delicious, I want more of that, whether it has salt or sugar in it. And so it's been quite a journey to get her to appreciate good food. And now we're at a stage where, and she's 10 years old, she's asking me for certain dishes that she, can you cook this for me, Dad? Can you cook the broad bean risotto, Dad? Can you cook the beetroot, you know, pappardelle, Dad, you know? So I reckon, you know, a little bit of perseverance with children can actually work. I mean, we are the parents. We get to decide what they eat. And I think her food habits in her future as an adult will be beneficial because of the experience she's having as a kid.
Given the various issues about the kind of ways we live our life in terms of sustainability, the environment, everything else, a lifestyle choice like this must inherently feel like a political choice. I mean, do you feel that by living this way, you're making a difference apart from to yourself and your immediate family?
I'm not making a difference by cutting down what my family purchases at the supermarket, but the difference I'm making is communicating it and writing stories about it. And there is a whole movement, there's a groundswell, in fact, of people questioning the current system and saying, look, you know, I'm not really happy about people working on 417 visas, you know, working in challenging conditions. I'm not happy about the pigs being treated in factory farms. I'm not happy about the road miles my food has. So there's the beauty of social media is that this groundswell is people are communicating with each other and sharing stories. And I think that's going to make the biggest impact. If I was just to remain living in the hills and not communicate my story and not share my story, then I wouldn't be making any difference at all. But by communicating the story of living this particular lifestyle, it, in a way, is aspirational for other people that can say, you know what, I'm going to take some of these elements and incorporate that into my family who are living in the inner city of Thornbury or Redfern or somewhere like that, and incorporate some of those things, and maybe I might be able to live lighter a little bit like Rowan and his family does.
I like the way you identify that some of these choices in to a different scale can happen within the city, but part of what's so nice about your book, A Year of Practiculture, is it is very much a seasonally focused book, and there is a sense of the way in which being a little more, a little out of the kind of rhythms of a city, make you more connected with seasons. It's been a pretty cold winter in Victoria this year. How do you deal with winter?
The entire book is based around, it starts in springtime and it follows, you know, a continual narrative of preparing for winter. And we have this, you know, 8 to 12 weeks where I live in the Central Highlands, where even the farmers that have lived there for 60 years just want to escape. It is absolutely horrible. That's what the entire process of the book follows, is the process of growing as much fruit and vegetables and preserving that, so that, that 8 to 12 week period during winter, it can be horrible conditions and you've still got food. And that's a system that has worked in, you know, European communities where they've battled the cold winters. It's worked for thousands of years, and that's pretty much what I'm following. I'm following those peasant principles of living like a peasant, growing food over the summer period, harvesting it and eating it during winter.
Isn't there a certain luxury to living the peasant lifestyle? I mean, you know, how do you do it? It takes time. What about those of us who have kids and jobs and yes, and don't haven't run ourselves into the ground first working 6 days a week so we can afford to do it?
And I love this question the most. When I lived in the city of Ballarat, right in the heart of the city, I had a 9 by 9 metre backyard. I worked 6 days a week. I grew, 1 year I grew 22 kilos of tomatoes in my backyard. I grew loads of pumpkin, and it wasn't until I moved out to the country where I had a little bit more land. Now I have a 14 metre by 12 metre backyard of vegetables, which is pretty much the average size Australian backyard. I still work a full-time job and manage to grow as much food as possible. The secret is growing veggies actually doesn't take that much time. The other beneficial thing I did was get rid of my television. So at night times, I either spend time with the kids, or in summertime, I'll be, you know, stringing beans up on wire to dry them out, or I'll be spending a little bit of time in the garden. It's all about how you choose to spend your time. In my old life, I used to spend approximately 3 to 4 hours a night watching television.
Rowan, it's the golden age of television. What are you doing, man?
I know. I'm telling you right now, for me, this worked really well. I've discovered that it comes down to choice. You can choose to watch 3 to 4 hours of television, or you can choose to do something productive with your time. You know, we only get one life, and I've made a decision to utilise my time as practical as possible.
You're an overachiever and virtuous to boot. But look, growing vegetables might not take time, but you mentioned running workshops teaching people to skin rabbits. Yes. The hunting part of what you do is a little bit different. And I'm really interested in this. I hosted an event the other night about trying to make farming the new rock and roll. We're going to play it on Blueprint for Living in a few weeks' time. And Matt Fowles from Fowles Wine, yes, was saying he can't serve wild rabbit that he's hunted himself in his restaurant. Do you, yeah, think we have issues with eating hunted food in Australia?
Yeah, I think there is. It's quite restrictive. I mean, if you go to other countries, they you know, places like Italy, for example, when it comes to fish or hunted game, I mean, the amount of times that, you know, I've seen wild ragu somewhere at a restaurant in Italy, I mean, look, I've only been there twice, but, you know, it's part of that culture, and it's not our restrictiveness and our legislation, especially in places like Victoria. There's a fear of the meat being unsafe to eat. Even as a small producer, people are challenged by the restrictions that are put on them. We have an opportunity here in Australia, in Victoria. We have an overpopulation of kangaroos, for example. It seems completely logical to be harvesting the most sustainable meat and serving that to people, as opposed to intensively farmed, you know, a lot of, you know, sheep and cattle are hard on Australian soils. We need to re-look at the way we view the best way to get the food to the plate and its impact on our environment.
And just quickly, Rowan, do you have a favourite winter recipe in the book that you would steer people towards? What's going to keep us warm?
You know, I do have a soft spot for slowly braised venison shoulders, shanks, kangaroo tails, any of those, you know, delicious meats that can be cooked over a 10-hour period and they just melt in your mouth. There is nothing better than that over a good mashed potato or, you know, roasted cauliflower mash or something along those lines. That is so heartwarming. And to know that you've grown the vegetables and hunted the animals makes the food a little bit more enjoyable.
You've inspired me and made me hungry at the same time. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
No worries. Thank you.
Hunter, farmer, writer, and thoroughly busy person in the kitchen, Rowan Anderson. His latest book is called A Year of Practiculture, Recipes for Living, Growing, and Cooking with the Seasons. It's available in all good bookshops. We've popped one of those recipes up on the Blueprint for Living program page for you to have a look at.